Welcome to 60 Scales and the Truth, a podcast where amazing guitar players reflect on their lives and on how they got where they are today. My name is Niels Guns. I'm a journalist, podcast maker, and a guitar fanatic. Thanks for tuning in. My guest today is a really versatile player. Born in Israel, raised in Boston, the sister of a mean shredder, while she has some insane chops of her own. Friends call her Niels.
That's right.
She is, as she puts it herself, too real to fake. Welcome to this episode, Niels. Neely voice. Explain it to me, too real to fake. That's the name of your tour right now. Right?
Yes. Thank you. Thank you for the kind words. You know, it all really comes from my love of playing live, and live playing being as real as it gets, you know what I mean? Like warts and all, life on the road, things go wrong, you know, click comes through the house and we make a joke out of it kind of thing. So, I just kind of wanted that to be a reminder of my generation still going out and doing the real live thing.
Seeing you perform.
Yes.
Hey, I mentioned in the intro you have Ethan, your brother.
Yes, of course.
I want to go back to the moment you got in touch with the guitar, right?
Yes.
Like was he also part of that?
Yes, absolutely. So I always looked up to Ethan and thought that he was really cool and he played guitar, you know. And it kind of came a little bit separately from that because it was clear to my whole family that I loved music very deeply, and it was clear to them that my ears were reaching for things and I was being influenced by things and being part of not just Ethan being my brother, but the rest of my family being older than me. You know, they had different influences and listened to Queen and Pink Floyd and things like that. Mm-hmm. So even though I was growing up in the 90s, I was exposed to those things. And I think it was obvious to them that it was hitting me in some way. So when I was, I think, 7 years old, I actually kind of just was reminded of this story in one of the clinics that I did this past week, because someone asked a similar question. And all of a sudden I had this childhood memory of my mom taking me to the local conservatory in Israel, in the town that we lived, to kind of have them gauge what instrument I might be apt for.
When you were seven.
Something like that, I was like, oh, I want to pick up an instrument. This would be, you know, music lessons would be good for you, et cetera. So I remember, I don't know why this was their gauge, but for some reason, I remember them giving me like a call and response rhythm test, right? Where they would just clap out a rhythm and I would have to clap it back and it would gradually get more difficult until they would kind of try to stump you type of thing. And again, I think back at that, I'm like, I don't know why that was their gauge for what you'd be good at, but sure. Mm-hmm. And so I remember when that little test was over, they started listing the names of the instruments that they thought I might be good at. And I just remember things being listed and then them getting to guitar and I stopped listening because I was just like, what? You really? You think that I could do that? Because that's cool. Like my brother, I didn't think that, so I think it kind of started from there.
He's a few years older, right?
He's 9 years older. Yes. So at that point, it was a very, very big age gap when I'm 7 years old, obviously. So it kind of started from there. And I started taking lessons. I had kind of like a three-quarter sized nylon string guitar that was still too big for me. I was a very small kid. And I took lessons. I wasn't very serious about it, obviously, as most kids would be. So I would not really practice and I would quit the lessons and come back or whatever. But by the time I was 11 years old, I discovered extreme. And again, through more than words like everybody else, but later on discovered the rest of the album through my brother who said,
surprise then, right?
Well, exactly. That's what I was just about to say, that he was just like, man, you don't even know, like the rest of this record is like totally different, you know, but you're going to dig it, you know? So kind of song by song, I got into that and it completely changed my life. You know, I just, when I heard that funky metal thing that Nuno did, it was just like, it opened up my mind. And that brought me to wanting to play electric guitar for, not because I like music and this would be something that I might be good at, but just because now the music that I was influenced by and really loved and listened to had this instrument in it. And now it's the music that I wanted to learn how to play. And so that's really what got me to want to practice. And so by the time I was in high school, I was really seriously practicing electric guitar. And then at that point, we were living in the States and I'd had different teachers and different paths and everything. But I had started taking it seriously a little older.
And then in what way did it help? Because Ethan is
a great player. Really amazing. Player. Yeah.
And I was surprised, like, how can two really, really great, great players come from that same family?
You know,
like,
thank you. Yeah.
But how did that help? You know, did you look up to him or like what happened? Or was he helping you?
Mm. He never really gave me formal lessons or anything. But where it really helped a lot is I always had someone to ask, have you gone through this? You know, like it's not like one person is a full community, but nothing of this world was ever foreign to me because of him. So anything that I'd ended up going through or thinking about or, you know, mental process when it comes to learning music or being a guitar player, it was like, well, yeah, of course. Yeah, I went through that, you know, and that was really super helpful because I already had an understanding of the culture of it, so to speak.
But it's great that he helped you in that. Yeah. And you played in his band also, right?
I did. Yes. Yeah. We toured together and yeah, I played rhythm guitar in his band and it was awesome. I mean, he writes great tunes and it's fun to play.
What's he doing nowadays? I don't want to talk the whole time.
No, it's okay.
it's okay. It's about you.
You know what? It's all good. He plays with Fifth Angel. Mm. So I think he's doing more Europe stuff with them, actually.
Okay, because he released some solo albums and not, like, I checked and I was like, oh, he didn't do any solo albums recently, right?
Or not? I don't know if he's toured that stuff recently. I mean, we definitely have in the past.
So, okay, young Neely got infected by Nuno.
Yes, absolutely.
Like a lot of guitar players were.
Yes, exactly. But, you know, not just the Nuno thing, but Extreme as a band, you know, was like my first love and it was like my favorite band. And Gary Cherone was my frontman idol. And and I was very much like young kid super fan. That was my favorite band. And I was like, I have the same initials as Nuno Bettencourt. I bet that means something. You know, it's just like, I was very much like a little girl, fangirl. And then when my family moved to Boston, I was selfishly very excited about that because I'm like, oh, that's where Extreme came from. Yes. And at the time we moved, which was 2000, the band wasn't together, but the members had all different projects of their own. And they were doing that around the Boston area. So my parents, being the lovely, wonderful, supportive people that they are, would take me to all these appearances and around New England and the guys were so lovely to me as at the time it was, you know, there weren't a lot of 12-year-old girls around in those hangs, you know what I mean? So the guys were super nice to me growing up and really taught me how to treat people. It was like wonderful. They would invite me to sound checks and because I couldn't go to the club gigs because I wasn't 18 or 21 or whatever it was at the time. So
you, 12-year-old girl.
I know, it's like, so weird, right?
Yeah, but I'm trying to figure out, like because it says something about you that you there weren't any other 12-year-old girls.
And at least not at that time, period, you know, and chasing those guys' solo projects.
But you were like, I'm going to be there.
To me, it was like a dream come true, especially coming from Israel. I was like, you mean I get to like, I can go and I can meet those guys. I can ask him for a picture. You know, it was like incredible to me, the concept that you could get up close to them for that reason. And it was a lot more intimate in that sense in those times when you're talking about club gigs or a clinic or a signing appearance, you know, when Nuno had Mourning Widows and, you know, that's what they were doing that Saturday in Nashua, New Hampshire, you know? Yeah. So it was like, me coming from Israel as a little kid thinking I can just, my parents can just take me to the music store and I can just stand in line and wait to talk to, I mean, what? That's crazy. Mm-hmm. So.
Well, what's so appealing? You said, okay, Gary was my favorite frontman.
Yeah.
And Nuno's, but what specifically you think, and then I'm referring maybe more to Nuno's playing, is it what you really love?
Yeah. I mean, I think, well, Porno Graffiti was the album that, again, really changed my life. And still to this day, I mean, I can listen to it and the first album as well and like really feel like I'm 10 years old, or this is like the sound of my childhood. It really takes me back. But I don't know. I mean, I really do always go back to that funky metal thing that mm-hmm. he did so well, like mm-hmm. the riffs on that record and all the guitar work and just the sonic choices and the post Van Halen influence and all those things. He just, I don't know, just sonically, it just hit me.
It just sounds good.
Yeah, it just sounds so yeah. good. Yeah, 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 exactly. Who can argue with that album? You know what I mean?
Yeah, but the rhythm, yeah, and the sound, yeah.
It was just so unique. I'd never heard anything like that before. And I didn't know Van Halen at that point, you know? Mm-hmm. So I didn't come from that first. And
so
then
Nuno was your Eddie.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, really, because... Yeah. Growing, I mean, I was born in 1988 and this is what I was taught. And so it was later on that I understood where I came from and what the history really is. But you're right. That is totally how I perceived it.
For people who are listening to this and not seeing the video, Neely is wearing an extreme shirt,
well,
of course.
Of course. Well, you know how it is on tour. It's like, what's clean in the suitcase today?
Yes, it's clean.
Ish. We've been on tour for a little while now, so.
Hey, but you, and so there's still, of course, a long way from really liking music
right.
and thinking like, oh, this is really nice,
sure.
to thinking like, okay, this is really my calling and,
yes.
and I want to be a pro and invest.
Yeah.
Can you tell me about that journey, so to say?
Sure. I mean, you know, like you're saying, I mean, I think I always dreamed about it as a kid, like I hope this could be a real thing. I love music, but I don't know what that really entails in real life. And this is a nice fantasy, right, as a kid. But I think, again, going back to the fact that I had a brother who took that path first, went to Berklee College of Music, became a professional musician. I don't want to say the path was laid out for me, but again, having that example of, well, at least this is one way that you can do it. Mm-hmm. It already takes care of a lot of question marks in your mind, because especially these days, being a self-employed do-it-yourself musician is... Because it can be whatever you make of it, you can also not know where to start, because there is no set path anymore. And so I think it helped the guidance from probably what would have been chaotic misunderstanding if I was on my own, to kind of having, okay, well, you can go to Berklee. That's a start, you know. Or so even in high school, it's like, well, how do I make sure that I'm learning the right things to be able to do well in that school? And then in that school, it's like, okay, well, so how is this preparing me for real life? And it just, you know, the inquisitiveness of figuring out how to get from point A to point B, mm-hmm. I think, is like the big thing that I was always just kind of like, okay, how is this possible?
And that path not being set as a musician, do-it-yourself musician, as you say, is that something that fits your personality, or are you like, oh, sometimes it's super frightening as well?
I think it's a lot of both. Yeah. Yeah. Because, I mean, you can really look at it any way you want. I mean, I think the blank slate and the possibilities for monetization and different things that you can do and skill sets that you can develop and how that can creatively make you money, for lack of a better term, like make a living for you, mm-hmm. is if you look at it as a creative outlet and a interesting way to figure that out, then it could be kind of a fun game, challenge, however you want to look at it, right? But like you're saying, it's also it's really frightening, and experience, I think, counts for everything. Mm-hmm. So
because you have a lot of cool videos, for instance, right. on there. One thing, if it's super funny, if I see you play, I watch your fingers.
Okay.
But also your mouth.
Yeah, I know. People tell me that there's stuff going on that I'm clearly not voluntarily.
So cool. Your mouth. I mean, it's the complete. Yeah.
I mean,
what do you react to what you're playing?
I'm definitely. Yeah, I've always been the kind of player that I want to feel every note. I want to do this, like. I want to do this for a reason. Mm-hmm. You know, every note matters to me. I'm not trying to not be there. I want to be as present as possible for every moment I can.
And so are you actually making sound or are you singing along or not? Like
in my head, I think. Yeah. Sometimes I do. You wouldn't hear it, I guess, because it's pretty loud.
The amp is up.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, okay, you kind of you went to Berkeley. That's all known, of course, and that's still in a way protected environment.
Absolutely.
Right? Is it super competitive there though, or?
I didn't feel like it was. I mean, you know, I went to Berkeley between 2006 and 2009, so I imagine it's a different school now. Mm. I mean, I know it's a different school. It's completely, even the infrastructure and the real estate and all the studios and everything that they have there is like new and unrecognizable to my time class. But I didn't feel like it was competitive. I actually was worried about it being that way when I went into it and got the pleasant surprise of one of my favorite things about Berkeley, which was actually one of my reasons for wanting to go, is that for an undergrad program, not just in music, but of any kind, it had, at least at the time, I'm pretty sure it still does, but had the highest rate of international students out of any school in America. Mm-hmm. And that to me was a really big thing, because coming from somewhere else, but also wanting to be immersed in different influences was kind of the thing that I was looking for, because I wanted to become versatile. But at the time, I didn't feel like I had the drive to expose myself to those influences. I felt like I have to be dropped into the pool and like be forced to like be surrounded by it. That's the way that it's going to work for me. And that, and also the friendships and wanting to connect with people from all over the world and understand where their perspectives come from and how they perceive music. And those are all the reasons that I wanted to go there. And it's really what I got from there. And so it pleasantly surprised me that the vibes from all those people and all that variety was nothing but positive, and everybody wanted to bring different things to the table. And that is what makes that school so special. At least at the time that I went, that's how I really felt about it.
But did it help you, because you moved to the States from Israel when you were
early teen, 12.
And it's, then I can imagine that does something with your identity, right? I'm from Israel and everything's new.
Yep.
So did that environment help you also give answers to that question,
so
to say?
I think so, in some ways, and probably more unconsciously, because as I'm talking about it, I'm like, that almost sounds like what I'm trying to say without me even thinking that might have been a part of the reason. But probably, I mean, you know, it's such a interesting thing to come from somewhere but spend so much time. I mean, I've now spent 2/3 of my life in the US, and I don't really feel like I'm American, and I don't feel like I'm Israel. Like, I don't know what, you know, so I've always kind of felt like I'm taking things from every culture, but being around other internationals just felt like home to me in a lot of ways. And so there's got to be some sort of connection.
Mm-hmm. But 12, that's a special age too, right? It's like
special is a nice word to use for that, right?
No, because it's the end of your childhood.
Exactly. It's such a tricky time. And the interesting thing is, like, I mean, I spoke English, so, and my parents actually had a previous relocation to the States before I was born, when my brothers were little. And so growing up, I had this like kind of idealized idea of what living in the United States is like by my family, and them being like, oh, you love it, you'll totally fit in, because, you know, I was a tomboy. I liked sports and music, and in Israel at that time, like, the other girls in school were not into the same things. I was very made fun of for that. And so my brothers were like, all the girls play soccer in the US, you'll fit right in, you know. It was just, I was so like sold to me, like I was very ready to go. And because I spoke the language and because I was told all these things, I completely didn't expect really how tricky it was really going to be and how much of a culture shock it was going to be. And so, of course, the first couple of years were definitely a lot more challenging than I could have imagined. But I couldn't be more grateful for it, because it still ended up being a great place to grow up and learn. And, you know, I'm very grateful for it.
Because I can imagine you have to overcome a lot of things then. Did that help you later on in your career with finding some kind of mentality?
I would imagine so. I mean, because, you know, thinking back at it now, I've, of course, gone through tough periods in my life, just like everybody else does. But, and now I'm thinking about it, I'm like, that probably still was mentally or emotionally the hardest thing that I had to do. And so it's got to be in comparison. It must have made me strong in a certain way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's
because it can't be as bad as coming into seventh grade in a new country.
Mm,
and yeah. Also the other thing at the time, just I know we digress, right? But like the other thing is so in Israel, junior high is from seventh grade to ninth grade, and then high school is 3 years. And where I was in the States, middle school is sixth grade to eighth grade. So I thought everybody was going to be new in seventh grade.
Mm.
And then I was the only new kid.
Mm.
So I thought it was at least going to be like, yeah, we're all starting in a new school.
Mm. Okay. So you were an outsider.
Yeah. And I was very adamant about the fact that I was like, okay, I speak English, so don't put me in an ESL class with help. I want to know that I can do that. Like it was like an ego thing of like, I want to be, leave me with everybody else and I'll kind of fit in. And then looking back, I was like, yeah, you know, maybe if I just accepted help, not because I needed help with the English, but just as a way to soften the landing a little bit and the integration, you know. But it was like literally the ego of a 12-year-old girl being like, no, I can speak this language, I'm good, just leave me here.
Yeah.
Oof, what did I do?
Yeah, of course.
It's such a funny thing to think about now.
Yeah, but I think everything in your life gives answers to what's happening now also in your career, right?
You're actually making me, I've never even thought about it in that way. And this is such an interesting conversation because it's kind of opening my mind to that. And now I'm going to reflect on how that might have made that connection. It's really interesting.
Because as a musician, and specifically also the music you're making, right? It's not like it's instrumental,
right,
guitar music.
It's commercial music. It's, no. Yeah.
And you need help.
Right.
Right.
I mean, everybody always does. Yeah. In any music.
If you're going to be like, fuck you guys, I'm going to do it myself. Okay. In a way it works, but
you're going to be very lonely if at work at best.
And now you're basically part of the big family, right? I mean,
I right? definitely feel that way. We have a great community, guitar players. We really have like, I feel really proud of our community.
Why? Tell me. Explain.
Because I think I hate separating things into generations. It feels so strange to me, right? But like between the heroes that I grew up on and us who are trying to forge our own way in the industry and things, the percentage of wonderful humans that are heroes is just mind-blowing to me. And I've felt nothing but love from my colleagues, let's say, and I don't take that for granted. You know, just like you said, was Berkeley competitive? It's like you never know what you're gonna get, and I don't want to assume anything. I just kind of try to go in with no expectations. And to feel like it's such a warm family and every player loves every other player and every player praises every other player, and you hear it all in interviews, and everybody's connected, and it's like one degree of separation from who you worked with, who this person worked with. I mean, it's like, it's a beautiful thing. And you feel that warmth carries over everywhere you go, and there is always a connection, just like today. Like, we're at a venue where we had so many friends who played here, and it's felt, it's palpable, and it makes the music better, and it makes people feel better, I think, you know. So I like the friendships.
But talking about that one big family, one returning theme in this series is a question from a previous guest to the next.
Yes.
And Paul Masvidal of Cynic asked you.
So awesome. I love Paul.
Yeah, yeah. He asked you this.
I would ask her how, because she does a lot of different types of, she plays with a lot of different kinds of musicians, she's a very versatile player, and I would ask how she is able to keep herself, because she has to fit the mold of Danny Elfman and all these different projects that she's doing, and how does she maintain her own voice in the midst of all these different hats she's wearing.
That's a great question. If I have to come up with a question for your next guest, it won't be as good as that one.
By the way, because he's connected, he played with Death. Death played, Gene Hoglan was in there, and you played with Deadlock. And hey, who's there? Gene Hoglan.
Exactly.
One big family.
Yeah, yeah. And I know it's not our only connection. It's just the top of the head one is right there. Paul is so wonderful. I love you, Paul. So, I mean, if anything, I feel like it's actually kind of hard to take myself out of it. Sometimes I feel like, am I putting too much of me into these other projects? Yeah, because I feel like whatever I interpret, like take Death Clock, for example, right? I mean, obviously I'm playing all the riffs. I'm getting my right hand up to speed to play all the things in time and well and clean and et cetera, right? But I feel like I'm not really a thrash player or a death metal player. I didn't really come from that, you know. So even though I understand the techniques and I think I know how to make it sound good, I'm like, but is it too like whimsical? Is it too jumpy? Is it too like, you know, it's like, because I can't take myself out of it.
Yeah, yeah.
So if I get a nice word from any boss that feels like the sound I'm bringing to the table is working, then I'm like, okay, then that means that I didn't bastardize your thing too much with my voice.
Yeah. But it's, I can imagine, like it must be a difficult thing, because you play with your own band,
right?
Then it's just you. I mean, right, it has to sound like you.
Yeah.
But you play with Danny Elfman,
right.
Death Clock, but also with Cirque du Soleil. Yeah, I can imagine there. Neely.
Yeah, it's but different.
You look different on stage right?
Absolutely.
You wear a wig and all.
Yeah.
Like, so for every gig, you have to search like how much Neely can be in.
Yeah,
right?
Exactly. So maybe really that's the gauge. It's not how do I put myself in it. It's how do I take myself out of it.
But I can imagine they also want you, because you're you.
Yeah, you want to. Yeah, right. So it's like, it's the right balance maybe. Yeah, it's how do you strike the balance?
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, any gig that I've ever done, I mean, I think it starts with honoring the music. And to me, being a good side woman is to try and understand, how do I support the bigger picture to sound as best that it can? What choices do I need to make here to make this what it's supposed to be? So in Death Clock, that means one thing. And in Cirque du Soleil means another thing, right? But like, for example, with Cirque, sometimes it's a clearer vision of what you need to do to achieve that. Like if I need to play the beat at solo while walking backwards in heels and getting ready to aim and shoot fire, that's a very specific task. You know, there's no question marks there.
It's dangerous.
It is extremely dangerous. Yeah. We have a lot of safety trainings for those things. And yes,
there's a lot of wig and all. Wow.
This is the reason why my wig is the only one that cannot get hairspray.
Ah.
You get and our wig.
I didn't imagine this talk going here.
Oh, believe me, there's so many details like that about that gig. It's being so different than everything else. It's got all the fun stories that you're like, oh, yeah, you know, I never would have thought of that, but that makes complete sense. So the wig team really hates my one wig, because it never does what it's supposed to, and they have to maintain it so much more because they can't put hairspray in it. And there was one time where I was like, no, stop, like. It's that
the wig team. I learned so much while doing series. There's a wig team. I didn't know.
Is there a wig team? Some of those wigs are made of human hair as well. And every individual hair is sewn into the wig. It's like handmade, and the teams, like, they treat them like real hair. And if you walk in there in the middle of the day, they're sitting on, they're not really mannequins. They're stands with a head shape on it, and the wig sits on it, and you see like somebody steaming it, combing it, blow drying it. It's just like they treat it as if it's on a person, but they're just like treating it all day long. So the other wigs can withstand all this stuff, and then they're just all frustrated with me because it's like, well,
there's not really a bridge from wigs to Danny Elfman, but like, does he wear wigs? I don't know.
No, he doesn't. But but big productions, I think that's the running theme.
Ah.
Big production to another big production.
Big production, but also a super interesting musician,
yes.
Right? I mean,
yes.
I went to the theater
just
because I knew he was the composer for a film. I couldn't care less about
the movie.
The movie, yeah.
Exactly.
But
yeah.
Like, so how did you get to play with him, by the way?
So this is actually the funniest, craziest story. I love to tell this because I can't believe things like this still really happen. But it was in 2020, right before the pandemic, actually. I was coming back. We were just at NAMM It was January, beginning of 2020. Nobody really knew anything yet, except that we all heard that the Namthrax was curiously really bad that year. Mm. Really something nasty was going around.
Yeah.
And I ended up basically having to sit that entire NAM out because I threw my back out on the first day. Mm. I don't know. I had a massage that went wrong. Didn't drink enough water. I don't know what I did. I woke up, I coughed, and like it was one of those things where I couldn't move. And I just remember being so bummed out and also just kind of hard on myself. I was like, man, I don't know what I'm doing this year. My schedule is really empty. What is 2020 going to look like? Which is the most ridiculous statement nowadays, thinking back, right? Yeah. It's like, yeah, gee, what is my... I have no idea what my 2020 is going to look like.
What was the last pandemic?
Yeah, nobody was thinking that. So I was just like, man, this was a great networking opportunity. I can't believe I like missed out on it. I was like driving home from Anaheim to Vegas, all like back still messed up, all like beating myself up. And then I was like, this is pointless. Anyway, so it was literally 2 days later, like 10 p.m., you know, the phone rings. It's a number that I don't know. And I don't pick up because it's a number I don't know. And I'm like, they can leave a message. And I thought to myself, if it's a gig, they'll leave a message. Like there's no way this is important. I shouldn't answer. But if it is, they'll leave a message. And then literally my next thought was, it's never a gig. You know, like it never is when you think that. And I went and I took a shower. I remember it just because it was just like so crazy. And I didn't think about it. I got out of the shower, checked the voicemail. Hi, my name is Melissa. We're calling from Danny Elfman's studio. We have a show that we might want you to play guitar for. We'd love to hear back from you. You know, like, what?
Wow,
my jaw was like on the floor. Mm. So Melissa McGregor, who's Danny's studio manager, was his studio manager at the time. I think just her job title might be a little different. Part of Danny's team called me up, and they didn't know if they were looking to hire another guitar player. They were kind of thinking, because they had at the time Coachella of 2020, what was supposed to be 2020, coming up, and he was putting a band together for that. And at the time, well, they didn't tell me who it was, but they had hired Josh Freese and Robin Fink and Stu Brooks to play bass. And so they were thinking about hiring another guitar player. And she had asked a composer friend of hers, Mikkel Herwitz, who went to Berkeley with my brother. She asked him for a recommendation. And I didn't remember knowing him through my brother at the time or anything. I didn't remember his name at the time. And I guess he dropped my name in the hat. And they asked him to ask my brother for my phone number, and actually got my phone number and called. And because I had a Boston area phone number, they were concerned that I live really far away. And they were like, are you in LA? Are you in Boston? What's going on? And I was like, I'm in Vegas. Don't let that scare you.
Yeah.
I can be there in 4 hours. Let me know when you need me. It's all good. I can come audition. Not a problem, you know? And we ended up having an audition eventually a couple of weeks later. And it was kind of thrown together pretty quick. They didn't give me a lot of time with the music, whatever. You know, I went in, auditioned, met Danny, had a wonderful time. We really hit it off from the very beginning. We spent time, like he really tried to get to know me with that day, which made it, I couldn't believe that he cared. You know what I mean?
Did he explain what he was expecting from you or what he was looking for?
At the time it was really like they gave me a few songs to learn and not a lot of time. I mean, we were like, yeah, maybe Thursday. So I just bought a plane ticket. I was like, okay, let's see if they tell me I need to go, I'll have the plane ticket, I'll jump on the plane. And they had sent me the three songs to learn as I was going to the airport. So I was on the flight, like listening to the stuff, and it was the next day. So I had like half a day to just like, okay, I'm going to learn the songs. And it was two old Oingo Boingo songs and also Sorry, which ended up being on the record that I ended up actually recording that song. Mm-hmm. I didn't even realize that. I knew it was not released, but I didn't know that it was going to be retracked and everything. So I went in and just basically was playing through the songs in the studio with the backing track, and they were behind the glass and just kind of seeing how it's going. But again, like he took the time to like ask me about myself and really like get to know me. And I was just like, I can't believe this. Like, I can't believe he's that cool. Like, this is mm-hmm. insane. And I'll never forget this. So like when the audition was over, he told me, he's like, wow, like you learned that stuff so fast. Like we really didn't give you a lot of time. Like I have to tell you, when you told us you lived in Vegas, I didn't even think you would show up. Mm. And I was like, I kind of took it as an opportunity. I was like, well, not to fangirl, but you know, like I love your music. I just wanted to be like, who are you calling? Like, who wouldn't show up for you? Let me slap them in the face, right? Because they dare stand you up. What's going on? So, you know, we really, and then I had a second part of the audition, which was auditioning with the rest of the band, and just seeing how we gel together. Because he cares enough that he wanted everybody to sign off on me and not just him, which is incredible to me. I think it says so much about him always treating us like a band and not like hired guns. And that was clear from the very beginning and beyond anything that I could have ever imagined or asked for. And
What did he teach you as a musician, so to say? What did you learn from his approach?
I feel like because he's who he is and he thinks so differently, but he also plays guitar and deals with guitar parts and writes guitar parts, he arranges things with completely different ears. So for example, like parts that you and I would think sound like one guitar part and would probably figure out how to play at once because you're like, well, no, I can play that and that at the same time. You know what I mean? But for him, it's that's not what it's about. So he cuts things in interesting places. He turns things into two sides or two parts in a place where you or I may not have thought to do that because we come from the most guitaristic way of doing everything. And he's just treating the instrument in the way that he hears everything. And so it just puts parts together in a completely, I guess, you know, it's more of like the orchestration way of him thinking about it. And so that to me was the challenge in this band is like, you're one of really three guitar players, most of the time too. I mean, Danny will play on some stuff, but like, how do you find the place to live and operate with an orchestra? Mm-hmm. We have 50 musicians on stage almost. So how do you bring something to the table? And plus, you know, it's reworking a lot of Oingo Boingo songs that were played a certain way. And he wants them to be played completely differently now. I mean, he doesn't want to play them the same way that he played them 30, 40 years ago, of course. So some of it really came to actually coming up with new parts and trying to figure out like how does this work for like a classic song that's completely reworked now with different musicians but still fits within the big picture and with everybody else and doesn't step on somebody else's toes, but still provides something for the song. So
I can imagine it's so super valuable as a musician to play with so many different kind of
exactly of yeah gigs, it's right? It's huge. That's why I say experience really counts for everything, because the question marks are only going to be removed with doing it hands-on and getting through the journey and problem solving and figuring it out and getting from not knowing how to make this work to everybody making it work together. And then the next time it makes more sense. And things don't seem as challenging on the next gig or on a different gig, even though it's something different. So yeah, it's perspective in a way, you know.
Isn't it cool that whole journey?
It's incredible. I mean, it's too real to fake, but I can't believe it's real. You know what I mean? It's like, I always tell my friends, I have this joke now that I sound like I'm in recovery because my motto has become one day at a time, because I'm just, honestly, I'm so happy to be playing with everyone that I'm playing with that I'm just like, keep me healthy tomorrow. Let me do this one more day, right? Like all I have is today, all I have is tomorrow. Like just let me do this for as long as I can. So it's like literally I sound like one day at a time.
You just mentioned the word healthy and then the words Jason Becker pop up in my mind. You know, and you obviously, because I know you visited him and
sure.
Probably because of that, but then I don't know. That happened when you mentioned that word, like also like fuck, such a great player.
Because you just never know.
Yeah.
And so, I mean, for me, on a personal level, it comes more from I dealt with some injuries while at Cirque du Soleil, just overuse, being in a heavy costume, heavy guitar, 10 shows a week, pretending you're a professional athlete because you're performing with former Olympians and you're like, one of these things is not like the others. You know what I mean? It's like, it's really nice to pretend, but at the same time, we all know who the musician is here and who the athletes are, right? Yeah. So, but that really taught me a lot. it brings you back to perspective. You're just kind of like, okay, taking care of myself and my shoulder and things like that are, again, real life. It affects your decisions. It's why I have a small fly rig head rush on this tour, and I could have rented a cab, but on this tour I'd be the one carrying it. Mm-hmm. Is it worth that versus having stage sound? You know, it's like, it really changes the way that you think, and because it is everything. If you are not healthy to play guitar,
but in the end,
it stops quick.
But you have to answer all those questions yourself.
Yes, you do.
Like, that's life also,
yeah,
right?
It is. It is. Yeah. It's definitely, you know, of course there's always challenging things, mm-hmm. but it's a privilege to worry about that stuff.
You visited Jason Becker a few times, right? Mm-hmm. Did he gave you some insights about that as well? Because obviously what happened to him is that what nobody wants to happen, you know?
Yeah.
But can you tell me something about your conversations with him?
I don't know if anything was brought up in like a really specific way about that. I mean, I don't know if we happened to talk about it, but I think it's more what you learn by being around him and just knowing him or being aware, even just being aware of him. I mean, just the testament to the human will that he is, and just his aura and the energy, and just, you know, watching his family take care of him and knowing that with the process of getting him to, from waking up to the day and to going to sleep, those processes take so long that his day is very short. Like his time of day of like really spending time is not as long as our days, and just the way that he's at peace with everything and the way that he approaches that, because that's his life and that's his reality. I think watching him and his attitude over everything is where you learn that from. I don't think it's like anything that he said, but just like, it's mesmerizing, you know? It's like, it's being around the most inspiring person you've ever met.
Mm-hmm. I know, we have a bridge towards the returning topic. Questions for other guitar players.
Okay. Oh, actually, I thought you were going to say, I mean, Jason's been brought up a lot on this tour because Atman Noor is playing drums.
Oh, of course.
So I've actually been seeing more physical copies of Perpetual Burn and Cacophony albums in the last 2 weeks than I have in my entire life.
Everybody wants Atman to sign it.
And it's just so fun to see it, you know, to see those physical copies come out of the woodwork and like just be handed. It's that actually really touched my heart more than so many things.
Brought mine. Cacophony.
It's all good. It's all good. You know where to find him. But it's strange, like which things will touch your heart in a way that you don't expect. But something like that, just seeing on tour, is like really big for some reason.
Of course. Hey, but what would you ask?
Okay, so I think I would ask him, how did you find the confidence to be fully yourself? Because he's so himself and he's so unique and he does things that nobody else does, but that takes courage in a way. What got him to the point where he felt like no fear to get behind himself fully?
Mm-hmm. And Neely. Or should I call you Niels? Maybe?
Sure. Niels. Yes, Niels.
We're almost towards the end of this conversation.
Oh man, that went by fast.
Yeah, right?
Yeah, really fast.
It's a bubble talking.
It sure
like this.
Is. When you got good conversation going.
Yeah, but
yeah,
the
great.
Last thing I want to ask, because you're constantly writing your own stuff. What about new material? Mm. What can we expect?
So the good news is my next album is all written. It's all demoed. Mm-hmm. But, you know, with the good problem of being on the road, I literally just haven't had the time to, I mean, take it from beyond sketching it out to really, truly recording it, mm-hmm. I have somewhat of an idea of personnel based on the instrumentation that I think it should have. But I also don't even want to say too much about that because those things might evolve and change. And I like to have the music guide me through what that's going to be. So unless I have final answers, I won't divulge too much. But much like my earlier albums, it'll be different. And it'll be...
That's the same.
Yeah, exactly. No, that's the thing, right? Like, it'll have different sonic directions in it, just like my...
Will be some crazy counting, like what's the song called?
I don't think
hip-hop.
No.
Fuck, I tried to count that song.
I didn't succeed. You know, I didn't write that, but according to Virgil, it's all in 4/4, which to you and me is like, really? I mean, like, technically, sure, it is, but yeah, the way that you count, it's like, yeah, listen to the hi hat. I'm like, what are you talking about? Yeah. No, actually, so I think this album is actually. A lot of it is going to be kind of retro pop with guitar on it. So again, I don't want to say too much and pigeonhole it to something, but it will have retro sonic qualities, 80s poppy kind of qualities. And again, it's all written. I have a good idea of who I think should be playing on it and what it should sound like. And I really
asked Virgil Donati, so he's going to make it sound.
Yeah, exactly.
Crazy.
But no, you know what? Actually, to be fair, you know, Virgil, as far as my album A Matter of Perception goes, he didn't just play on the crazy ones. Like, for example, he played on Silence of Saturday. And I think he's such a great example of the craziest drummer ever. But he knows how he will always play for the song and he does not overplay something that doesn't need it. So I think he did just the right stuff for the simpler songs than he did for, I mean, Alien Hip Hop is his own composition. So of course he's going to throw everything into it. Mm-hmm. But the thing that I love the most about Virgil is just, he's the, like, you know, he knows the right thing to do for the song. He's a great drummer. He's the greatest, one of the greatest drummers of all time for a reason.
Whatever the new music will be, people listen to it.
I really want to record this album. Like, I'm excited about it. It is a great problem to have, to not have time, but I'm at least excited about it enough and confident about the music enough to be like, yeah, I want to take the time to sit down and work on this.
But that's okay. This goes a bit longer than I thought, but in a way I recognize, and that's strange how that works. It takes an effort to put your true passion project first, right?
Yeah, it does.
Because
all the other things got thrown at you, and
before you know it, it all ends up on the bottom of the pile.
It is, yeah, and that's real life, and it's a privileged life. You know, again, it's a good problem to have. Like, I'm happy to be able to say that I don't have time to work on it, but you're hitting the nail on the head, because in the last couple of years, I'm like, wow, like, I really have to prioritize this. Like, you don't notice how much it goes into the back burner if you're not making decisions and taking steps. It's like it defaults to the back burner and you're just like, wow, I didn't realize how much of this is putting my foot down. And
I'm going to send you a message every now and then. Nearly record the album.
It's like self-care, right? It's like you have to take the time for yourself. And if you don't do it for yourself, nobody else would. And you really have to kind of fight for it sometimes. And that's how I feel about this now. Mm.
Thank you so much.
So many epiphanies today, my friend.
Well. It was great talking to you.
It's a pleasure, Niels. It's been a long time in the making. I'm so happy that we're at this day where we're really doing it.
Me too. Yeah. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
And listeners, thanks for listening.
Thank you, guys.